Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 21st, 2021, and welcome to episode 231 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and not much else today, but that's okay. I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts. The first on my screen is Blake Patterson in Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Today was actually quite a nice day. We had, it's nearly 70 degrees, sunny, a nice little breeze. So we spent the afternoon until moments ago walking around Georgetown, looking at blooming flowers and all sorts of pretty outdoor things. So not a lot of retro activity today in the house here, but maybe equally well spent, at least. So yes, doing well. Thank you.
Very, very good. And also joining us is Jack Nutting from Stockholm. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing pretty well. I don't know. It's still, you know, it's now been we've now crossed the cusp, right? We're now into over 1 year of Corona home time for most people that we weren't in last time we recorded a show.
True.
I don't know. End of a weird first year of this. I hope this isn't going to be like a multi-year thing. We'll see. I guess we'll see.
I remember this time last year, you know, thinking about, well, you know, maybe by July it'll be over so that we can have Kansas Fest.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, I think that it's nice that by the time we hit the year point, you know, there's large quantities of vaccines that are happening. So that makes it less dark a year point, certainly, I think, for me anyway.
True.
Not that I've been down that road yet, but as soon as I can.
So, yeah, so for me, first of all, we are recording this while I think that I have two unedited and unreleased episodes sitting on my hard drive. So, you know, sorry about that, but I have just moved. In fact, tonight is the night when I turn in the keys to the other place, and so I will no longer have access to it. But and I took the opportunity to run a bunch of stuff from my office, you know, my famed office. I've brought a few things home, so I have a cube, like a Mac cube at home. I have a Mac Classic, a Color Classic.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, Color Classic 1, right? The 2, I think the Japanese one. And couple other things. I brought a Trona Attaché that made an appearance on some prior episode. It's a very cute little portable CPM machine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I've been moving and not editing, so sorry.
You typically don't have many retro computers at your home at all. Is that correct? Mainly they've been in your office space. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's actually another thing about that year, you know, like because I'm not supposed to be in my office. You know, it's Sunday. Right. I snuck in. Don't tell anybody, but I'm of the category of employee that's not supposed to be on campus even, you know, because I don't have a testing cycle set up and that sort of thing. So I have not had access to anything but what was at hand, you know, like the few things. I had an Apple III at home and a couple of things, but almost nothing. So.
And now you have your precious hoard. You have brought a bit of it home.
Yeah, and probably already it's about 150% of what my wife would like. Anyway, so part of the task is going to be to set it up in a way where all the cabling is hidden. So that's one objection.
Right.
Often comes along with this stuff is the cables look terrible.
Easier said than done, I think.
Yeah. But okay, so let's see. I haven't caught up with the feedback, but the next time we do this, it'll be glorious. There'll be a topic. There'll be many, many people. It'll last 9 hours.
Next time, we'll have our ducks in a row. This time,
that's right.
This time the ducks are dispersed.
The ducks are just all going different directions.
Yeah. Ducks scattered.
That's right. You line up two, and the third one goes, and then you go get that one, and the first two are gone. We have an outdoor rabbit who shows up at our window at our old place, and the rabbits like grapes. Turns out, I don't know if I mentioned this before.
I believe that.
Yeah, it's like a spoiled little kid. You know,
right.
If there's a grape, the rabbit will eat the grape. Even if there's like good for you stuff around.
Yeah.
Skip all the nice, you know.
Yeah, that's my friend, the guinea pigs, who are supposed to eat nothing but hay, really. But if you give them grapes or tomatoes or bell peppers or whatever, they're like, yeah, please, we'll eat all that.
Yeah. It's really, this. That is like the one sad thing about this move that I've made, though, is that we were just sort of getting to know this rabbit outside, and then, you know, we bought this place, and we're now moving. So I'm going back to like give some last grapes to the rabbit.
Maybe you should capture him.
I don't think they do very well.
No, but capture him and bring him to the yard at your new place.
Oh, you think we have a yard?
Okay.
Sadly, I do not have a yard. But
maybe you should leave a note. Tape a note on the window, or hidden somewhere in the ceiling of a closet, so whoever moves in when they're good and moved in, they'll say, gotta get some that grapes. Yeah.
Because the rabbit will actually sit outside like a dog or whatever. Like it'll sit out looking in the window,
waiting
for it to open. But we recruited some neighbors to take care of the rabbit. But they think they also think it's cool. But that's like the sad thing, the main sad thing about moving. Everything else is pretty good. But anyway, so welcome to Rabbit Computing Roundtable.
I don't think there was ever a computer named Rabbit, right? Or was there Rabbit? No, probably not.
I don't know. Missed opportunity otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But okay, so I guess our topic is not feedback. It's not video to modern monitors because we just talked about that. So we're waiting for new people to come in to talk about these things. Unless Blake wanted to talk some more.
No, I'm good. I'm good. Okay. I had my say.
So I think what we'll do, this will be an accelerated edition of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Right.
And in honor of that, Blake, you can start with your first news item.
Okay. Let's see. So I guess Ian Kim, who we've talked to about before, who has made a number of Apple, 2GS or Apple IIe cards, I think. He's made a variety of Mockingboard clones. Paul, what else has he made?
I forget. I think he was the one who made there was something that would emulate like a game console or something. Yeah, I don't remember exactly. Mainly I remember like memory cards.
Yeah. Well, I know he's also made a card. He made a Mockingboard clone that's not one of his verbatim Mockingboard clones. It actually uses a different sound chip and gives it a sort of a different sound overall, which again is kind of a strange, it's a bizarre device to have made. And what he's created here also is a bit of a odd device. I just became aware of it last night, on one of the chats that I am in, whether it was Slack or IRC. What it is, it's called the A2 Turbo Card, and it's a 16 megahertz accelerator for the Apple II, 2 Plus, or 2E. It has a 6502, it's clocked to 16 megahertz. There's some associated controlling hardware, and he has various videos on the page that show it running, you know, certain things quite fast. You know, some games that are running, and it you know, you can see them, you know, running as you'd expect, 60 megahertz. But what it also does is, so it generates an IRQ non-maskable interrupt functions. So you can basically, in the 6502 on the Apple II, the Apple II doesn't have IRQ and non-maskable interrupts, apparently. Not being a, you know, Apple II assembly coder, I you know, don't have as much knowledge about this, but apparently it lacks these interrupts. It generates these interrupts, so you can actually intercept them with your software. And he has some examples where there are, you know, several things happening, like a basic program is running and audio is playing. And here we get into, I guess, perhaps the most unusual thing about this card. It has a DAC, digital analog converter, that is driven by the 6502 running at 60 megahertz, so it can actually output. There's an example shown where you're running a basic program he's written, and it's doing its thing, and at the same time it's playing like a digitized wave file at fairly, you know, high clarity, these things happening simultaneously due to the aforementioned interrupts. So it's a curious thing. And, you know, he mentioned, you know, on the page, he has some question and answers that he's set up, kind of a FAQ about, you know, about the device. And, you know, he said, why is there a, you know, audio capability on this accelerator? And he said, because I wanted that. so really, it is bizarre. Like, I thought I was reading it wrong. And someone said, well, look at his explanation. He said, I've added it because I wanted it on this card. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting mix of things. On the page that we will link, there's 8-10 videos that demonstrate the audio quality. Apparently, here's some examples. It can play on a 32 megabyte disk image. It can play 69 minutes of 8 kilohertz wave file music, or, you know, at the other end of the quality range, 17 and a half minutes of 32 kilohertz wave music. So the DAC will play pretty high quality music. If you have a reason to do that on your Apple II, it's an interesting thing. It sounds like it's coming for purchase, and it certainly is a unique device. So, yeah, there you go.
There was something, I don't know if it was this, there was something that people were talking about a little while ago that was supposed to accelerate your basic programs or something. And I think that I think this may actually be it. Like, I think he teased it or something.
Maybe.
With something that wasn't, it wasn't very clear about what it did. But
yeah. Well, even reading the description, it still was, I thought surely I was, you know, not quite getting a handle on the whole situation, but apparently I I was, as best as one can. Most of the demos shown are demonstrating the ability to run basic while other things are happening, because it's generating these interrupts. I guess if this comes forward and, you know, you purchase it, I don't know if it gets around issues of, I think it's a common thing that pops up in accelerator discussions in the forums. I guess DMA for, you know, certain like accelerators or, you know, hard drive controllers are impacted by card-based, slot-based accelerators, apparently, of which this is one, versus, you know, the CPU socket like a ZIP chip or a rocket chip. So I don't know if this, you know, causes issues with that. I assume it probably does. It's a curious device, but I thought interesting, certainly. So, you know, there it is. We'll see.
Yeah, I think, okay, there's a couple things that have come in on the chat. Thanks, Christopher. Ian Kim has an SD card device. I forgot what that was called, but I think I may actually have that. And then an MSX on a card. That was the thing I was thinking of, because he has a like a Z80 card, Z80 card. And I think the MSX is...
Right,
a computer based on that chip. So
yeah, as a side effect, I recall that wasn't the purpose of the card, I think, but as a side effect, you can emulate MSX, which seems also sort of an interesting thing.
That's, yeah, it's kind of cool. So he makes pretty cool stuff.
Yes, definitely.
But
yeah, I have a Mockingbird clone, and I feel like it may be one of the first things he made, but he may not have made it. I'm unsure. People have told me two different things. I've had it for some years, but I think it might be an early item that he made. But he's got some interesting hardware. Mm-hmm.
There have been a couple of Mockingbird clones that people have made. There's one that I think it might be the Ultimate Micro, Reactive Micro sells it now. That was you know, none of these people. It's possible that Ian Kim made one. I think Plamen in Bulgaria of A2 Heaven made one with like actual tubes on it.
Yeah, with vacuum tubes. Yes. I've seen that on eBay. I think there was one. I feel like there was one that had one tube, and then I saw one, I believe, that had two tubes, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. It was a white card, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. But A2Heaven usually uses those the white PCBs.
Yeah, but I see in the chat, Jeremy says he has one, and it works great from Reactive Micro. Yeah, I guess you get that deep, rich sound with that tube, that tube amp. You can, you know, it's master the audio to vinyl or something. Yeah,
very funny. Yeah, but the other thing about the interrupts, so I think by the time you get to the maybe Apple IIe, there are interrupts available like that, but early Apple IIs did not have the interrupts, and so there's certain things that if you wanted to have them, you could get a mouse card, because the mouse card would generate an interrupt, right, so that it could drive the cursor around the screen.
Right.
So it's probably, my guess is that this card is doing something sort of like that. And you could probably do all those same things with a mouse card and the software. But yeah, generally it didn't.
Yeah, I think the mouse card has its own 6.5 CO2 on board, if I'm not mistaken.
Don't know. That sounds a little bit too powerful for the mouse card, but maybe.
I can't remember. I might be wrong. I'll look into that. But yeah. Anyway, that's what we have there on Ian Kim's latest.
Cool. All right. And then I guess we can move to Jack. You have the next thing.
Yeah, I do. So there's an interesting new game publisher called Audacity Games that has popped up. They are publishing new games for the Atari 2600. And I mean, this has been done before. There's been homebrew forever. What's kind of fun about this is at least the first couple of games are made by industry veterans who are making 2600 games back in the day. So the first game is called Circus Convoy, and it's made by David Crane and Gary Kitchen. David Crane, known famously in the 2600 era for creating Pitfall 2, and also being, I'm pretty sure, one of the guys who started Activision. He was at Atari first, and when, I think the story goes that there are a number of programmers at Atari who were fed up with not getting credit for, you know, the work they were doing on these games, and they're like, okay, let's make our own company, and they did very, very well. So they launched a couple weeks ago their new game called, what's called Circus Convoy, which I did buy. They had kind of a difficult launch process over a weekend where it was going to be launched on a Saturday. And then at the last minute, they're like, no, our website's broken. Come back in 24 hours. So they have a launch video that shows some of the graphics of this. And so again, it's made by David Crane and Gary Kitchen. Gary Kitchen is known famously for making games like, what's it called? Crazy Cops? No, Keystone Capers. He did Keystone Capers. He did Donkey Kong for 2600. So this game has some elements that are recognizable style-wise from a bit from both Keystone Capers and from things like Pitfall. But what they've been able to do is, so it has some neat features. For one thing, it's a bunch of mini games. There's way more stuff going on here than you would typically ever have in a 2600 game back in the day, just because they have so much more space to do it. They realized when they were going to get started on this that they couldn't even buy 2K and 4K ROMs anymore, which was what the original 2600 cartridges were. The smallest they could buy was 128K. And I guess they were already planning on doing bank switching and realized, okay, well, if we're doing bank switching anyway, we can do a lot of bank switching. We can make bigger games that do more things. So it has a lot of things going on. And they've added some interesting features because they're looking at this as they're going to have more games and they're trying to be sort of a publisher that has a certain stamp of, in terms of user interface and things, how their games will look and work. So like one of the features of this is that when you play the game and get a high score, a QR code pops up on your screen and you can point your phone at that to register your score on their website. So every copy of the game is unique, has unique serial number inside of it, which is then used to generate the QR code, which will be unique for you. So they do some interesting sort of features there. I don't know. I guess it's not really computing in a sense, although it is, after all, it was the video computer system. But still, I think it's an interesting side note in terms of, you know, someone who was doing these things back at the time and now has kind of approached again with new eyes and built new tools around things and, you know, doing things to enable it to work in a bigger context than just a game running on a console. Think with things like unique serial numbers and the QR code business and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it's kind of a cool way to integrate, like, you know, the modern world in with
right.
the ancient world. I mean, like,
right.
Now that we have the ability to scan things on our much more powerful phones.
Right. And that it doesn't require any different hardware or anything. It plays on a stock 2600. They even have both NTSC and PAL versions. I think it's a neat concept. Like, and the game itself, it doesn't contain any flash RAM or any special features. It's just a larger ROM than usual. But there were games back then that did bank switching also. But then you're talking about an 8K game or maybe a 16K. But now they have 128K was, again, apparently the smallest they could find, they said. I watched some, they had some sort of launch video with both David Crane and Gary Kitchen. And also, I guess it's Gary Kitchen's brother, Dan Kitchen, who was also a developer at the time. And he's also working on their next game, which is called Casey's Gold. So the three of them were talking about their kind of process and how this sort of came to be. I shall see if I can find that video to link to it also, because it was a pretty interesting talk.
Interesting. Yeah, and the high score scan phone thing is interesting. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so it pops up a QR on your screen. It's a very small QR code in terms of number of pixels, because you can see, like, you know how there's like the corner pattern of a QR code, and there are different sizes available that contain different amounts of data. And this one has like the large corner that you always see I think it's usually the upper left corner of a QR code. In this one that it generates, they showed it on screen. It's almost a quarter of the whole QR code is just that upper left corner square. So there's not a lot of bytes in that, but enough apparently to encode a URL of some kind. So
50.
Excellent.
Oh, and to interject, yes, I think I was, my comment about the 6502, I was confusing it with, I remember reading quite a few years ago about the tech on it, and I was looking at the schematics, and it was the 6520, not the 6502, 6520. It has a peripheral interface adapter. And in my mind, it looks like it's about the same size as a 6502. And I was thinking for all these years that it had a processor, but nope, the two and the zero are
sixes and fives and twos. So this was end of January that Plex announced this. And I was kind of curious to know if anyone knew anything about it really. But so Plex, it's basically sort of like a video streaming self-hosted program, you know, so essentially it's like your own little Netflix or whatever, you know, you put your videos in it, it gives you an interface.
I use it and, you know, yeah, I've got like a handful of, you know, videos on the Mac here. And when you stream it out to like, oh, I'm on my phone, here's the Plex app, it knows to encode it in real time. It encodes it or does some further encoding to make sense as far as what bitrate it sends, and or if I'm watching it up on the Apple TV, it sends you the full you know shebang, you know. And I've got a friend that has, you know, thousands of videos, and I can share, tap into his library. Yeah, it's nice, but it's all been videos so far, videos and, you know, photos, maybe some images, static images, but.
Yeah, it's sort of like a media organizer, and they have added more and more as time goes on, you know, so they got into podcasts a while ago, and I thought that was good because, you know, I put all my media stuff in one place. That seems great. But I think I've ranted about this before. Like, no one does the podcast apps right. All I want is one that will synchronize across devices so I can listen on my phone. It will download things and archive them, like archive the feed and the media, so that when, you know, in the future when the server goes down and it no longer is feeding you these, you know, the metadata as well as the audio, mm-hmm. then I want to have it, you know. And so Plex added, they added podcasts, but they still treat them as if they are always there. Like, you know, so you can't store them, even though you can store audio, but you can't store them. it's an intentional decision. And I think, you know, so I can sort of see why a podcaster might, you know, like a podcaster who is paid might like you to increase their metrics when you listen to their show rather than download it once and share it with your friends. But it's so frustrating because a lot of these feeds just go away. And you know, even if I've downloaded the files, I have lost all the show notes. Mm-hmm. So, and yes, in the chat, by the way, many podcast apps do not do this right. You know, they don't download, they don't archive, or they exist only on one platform or another. But all of the podcast apps, whether they do it right or not right, will not have gotten any episodes of Retro Computing Roundtable since 228 because I haven't posted them yet. soon there's going to be like 8 hours of old Retro Computing Roundtables hitting the feeds as well.
What a glorious day that will be.
Yeah. No, it's true. Actually, I think the last two were like two, 3 hours long or something like that.
Yeah, they're pretty lengthy. They're
quite long.
Right.
So, anyway. So Plex does some things other than video. But the thing that they announced at the end of January was that they were adding gaming as well. It seems like what it is an interface to Parsec. Like, have you ever tried anything like Parsec or...
I haven't. I've not heard of Parsec. I mean, other than the TI video game, no.
Well, what a wonderful discussion topic this is going to turn out to be. None of us know anything about this. But like one of the things that is sort of notable, the reason that it hit my radar, at least, and Carrington's also, because I stole this from something that he put in the show notes, though I had also seen it because I am a lifetime subscriber or whatever to Plex, so I get notified when they do these new things. But one of the things they did is added basically a bunch of Atari 2600 games. Like, that's the sort of default game set that you get when you connect your Plex account with your Parsec account.
So anyway, this Plex gaming thing, so does it, do you like pay per game? Like, do you rent games? How does it, what is the model here? Do you know?
There is a subscription model. So, okay. There's something that you can try free for 30 days and then essentially it's a monthly fee.
Are the Atari games just a start to give you a taste and then there's other platforms or?
I think the plan is for more, but I think the Atari ones are the only ones that are there now. That's what I think. Anyway, the Atari ones exist. That is the RCR angle on this. and I mean, we talk about this all the time, you know, that the Atari 2600 games are interesting only if you have strong nostalgia for them.
Right.
Because otherwise they are terrible.
Mm-hmm. By and large. Yeah. There's not a lot of
nice part.
I mean, a lot of these games, yeah, they can be fun for a few minutes, but there's not usually a lot of depth to many of them.
Yeah.
For some reason, I can play several hours of, and it's the only version I like. I don't like any of the other versions of this game on the bigger machines, but Atari 2600 Demon Attack. I can just play hours and hours and hours of that. I don't want to play it on the TI.
That is fun.
Yeah, or MSX, or you know, on the Commodore 64. I just like the 2600 version. Yeah, that's weird.
But. I think I played a lot of the Atari 8-bit version before I ever played the 2600 version much, and they're virtually identical. Mm. Those two actually. So,
yeah.
Maybe I'll try some of that with my Plex subscription at some point. I haven't tried it. I just know that it exists.
Yep, go for some Demon Attack. It's endless fun.
Mm.
Cool.
Okay, all right. That's something like my news item.
Nice.
And Blake, you have the next thing.
Yes. So over at Big Mess O'Wires, the makers of the floppy Emu, or Emu is more fun, we decided. They have a floppy controller in the works, and I hadn't really been following it. I saw this update. It's a controller called the Yellowstone, a drive controller called the Yellowstone. And, you know, just as a news item, giving a heads up as far as, you know, more options being available for controlling devices, it was just announced that while the Yellowstone controller, which is, you know, fairly recent, has been working so far with 5 1/4 inch, controlling 5 1/4 inch floppy drives, and also controlling hard drives or hard drive, you know, emulating devices on the smart port, the GS style or smart port. They've added 3.5 inch floppy disk compatibility as well. And what makes it a little more interesting than just, well, you know, okay, obviously that would be a nice thing to have, is that it does it with, it's able to do it with the 1 megahertz Apple 65CO2, or I guess the 6502 if you're using an older machine, because theoretically those CPUs aren't fast enough to do the proper decoding to read a 3.5 inch floppy disk as Apple, you know, has arranged them, which is why there's apparently there is in fact definitely a 6502 running at 2 megahertz on the controller card that Apple, you know, put out, at least for the, I don't know if this is initial or, you know, which version of the 3.5 the author's talking about in this blog post, but apparently they say they use some very special tricks to achieve the floppy support. So with the standard CPU, it does work. So that'll be another option for controlling various devices. Yeah, so that's just about all on that item. It seemed always nice to see new ways to, you know, new interfaces that are popping out up on the scene.
Yeah, so I thought, I think this project has been going for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So what I thought what this was initially was a replacement for the Liron card. So this was the Apple made card. I don't know. I'm not actually sure why it's called Liron, but it, you know, it just says, you know, it says Liron on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the 3.5 inch floppy controller that Apple put out.
Is that the one that controls the Unidisc, or is that the one that controls the Apple 3.5 inch disk drive? Do you know? Because I think the Unidisc is a different situation.
I think you're right. I think maybe it is for the Unidisc. That would explain the encoding issue, because the Unidisc. Yeah.
Yeah. Liron is the Unidisc controller, and that was the first the white color floppy that came to the Apple II, and is not, you know, hardware compatible as far as interface wise with, you know, the GS style 3.5 inch floppy. It's a GCR 800K drive. Yeah, I actually had one on a 2E long ago, but
yeah. Well, so and so the Unidisc 3.5 has we've talked about it a few times before, but it has a 6502 in it as well. So you could, you know, do like a parallel processing with it. If you could,
right.
You could send it some little tasks to do, and it can compute some stuff and send you back some results. So that might be how it gets. You know, it might be that the drive is powerful enough to handle the encoding that this card is doing. But anyway, yeah. So I thought initially he was making the Yellowstone card in order to connect up with the floppy Emu, because the Liron card can do it. I've done it. I have one connected to a Liron card, but mm-hmm. But of course the Liron cards are hard to find. So mm-hmm. That doesn't work all that well. But the point of the Yellowstone was, I thought, to make that possible, but then I thought he abandoned it.
Okay.
And so it's good to see that it's back in progress, because I thought basically he had just said, like, I've gotten as far as I can get, you know, see ya, here's the stuff. If someone wants to take it further, go ahead, but I'm done. So mm-hmm. So I was surprised to see that this actually has proceeded. The floppy Emu is a great piece of hardware, and it's pretty cool that we have this ability now to connect it to a slotted Apple II.
You know, it seems to be in progress, and, you know, it wasn't, I don't think at any point the Yellowstone, you know, in whatever state it has been, has been offered for sale, but it sounds like, you know, if they're announcing, you know, the item starts out, you know, the article success, you know, so it sounds like, you know, this would indicate that this is coming in a meaningful way for people with, you know, trying to bridge these devices to their Apple II.
Cool. Yeah, this is, it's Steve Chamberlain, I think, right? Who I know, well, I think this came up before, but I'm sure it did. It always does. We repeat ourselves all the time. But he wrote Tetris Max, and that was a great, great game. It was completely unrelated to anything having to do with the floppy emu, but
I did not know that. I was unaware of that.
I played a lot of that game. it was very good. It was a good implementation of it. But
I'll have to look it up. I haven't tried that. I haven't run across that, I don't think.
I think there are two different versions with two different songs, but they're both good. And you hear that song a lot.
Did you say it was an Apple II game or a Mac game?
It's a Mac game.
Oh, okay.
Early shareware Mac game. Okay, let's see. I think we may have actually run through the items of interest and news that we had.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much slower we can go, so maybe we should move on.
Just power through.
To a word from our sponsor.
As a leader in business solutions, IBM's developed a new computer you can really hang your hat on. The IBM Application System 400. Whether you're in construction, banking, or mining, education, from manufacturing to medicine, retailing to ranching, the IBM Application System 400 can give you specific solutions for your specific business, no matter what hat you wear.
And we're back. And now is the time for the host's retro computing gift idea, and the gift idea this time is, well, Jack, maybe you can describe it. It's Atari Things on Redbubble.
Right. Not exclusively Atari Things either. So Steve Boswell does a lot of stuff in the Atari 8-bit community in terms of like 3D printable case designs for various hardware add-ons and stuff. And he's got a Redbubble page with some designs. So there are things like there are masks with various logos, Atari, Amiga, Commodore, Linux. You got a Boing mask, the Boing ball, the red checked ball. It's kind of nice. We got a ZX Spectrum rainbow thing going on.
I like those.
I don't know what this one is. Beeb Owl. Ah, the BBC.
Oh, yeah, BBC Micro.
Yeah, so there's a variety of things here. Let me back up a little bit. It's got some software designs on masks. There's a nice Yara's Revenge. There's a nice Ready prompt, a couple different ones. Also, there's the Atari one and the Commodore 64 one. Just different colors, different screen colors, both saying Ready. Yes, there's some kind of neat just like masks here. If you want a mask with some nice retro computing flair, you've got one. And I feel like there was more here.
They're pretty cool, though. These are like Carrington's bags or whatever. Like, you can identify somebody as having an Amiga or a...
That's right. Yeah, if you walk around with your Amiga check mark on your face.
Yeah. So, all right. So the Commodore and Atari Ready prompts...
Quite similar.
Really do look that close, that much alike.
They're very, very similar. There's a slight difference in the font, but they both, when you boot up, they say Ready and have, you know, a bluish background with a lighter bluish text color. Yeah, they're pretty similar. It's got some nice stickers here. It's got some coffee mugs. Commodore 64 classic mug, A500 classic mug. He's been busy. There's a lot of stuff here. I came across this at some point and shared it with the rest of you guys, and now we're looking at it. There's a nice Atari logo, like the GTIA rainbow scroll type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nice Atari Ready pillow. Throw pillow. Pillow. That's going in my shopping cart right now. That's something I need, obviously.
Yeah.
So, the Atari 130XE spiral notebook. Hold the phone. That's actually really nice. Yeah. So they have these spiral notebooks, and they're in a certain form factor that is like... just the right form factor for the Atari 130XE. That's actually beautiful. Man.
Cool.
So, nice. Yeah. So this is the host gift idea. It's kind of anything you find on Steve Boswell's nice Redbubble shop. There's a ton of cool stuff here.
There really is a ton of cool stuff. That's quite impressive.
Oh, I think I see some more throw pillows I have to have. I just need to have a sea of throw pillows.
Maybe we should move on to eBay before Jack buys everything.
Oh my gosh, look at that. The GTIA throw blanket. It's like a huge blanket with the Atari rainbow pattern on it.
Yeah. I'm going to have to.
Dang.
Wow.
This just gets better the farther I go. I feel like my wife would be on board with that.
Yeah.
I feel like I have to stop because I could just sit here all day scrolling and exclaiming about these things. But there's a lot. There's a lot to take in there.
I think some of those throw blankets, I'd end up using them in a guest room alone if I were to buy them and put them in place or to implement them in our bedroom. But they're very nice.
Well, it might be one of these things that it helps. You put them in the guest room to keep the guests from overstaying their welcome.
There you go. Exactly.
Yep.
Yes.
All right. All right. So when you're done, if you ever finish buying throw pillows and other various accessories on that store, we can now turn to eBay. And Blake has the first couple of auctions.
So the first item, I'm sort of bringing it up because, well, you know, it's interesting, but it's also more for the kind of a brief discussion it might spawn. So what I've got, it's a practical peripheral switchport 2C. It's a serial to parallel converter for the Apple IIc. It's an external device. And these are quite a few different groups made these things. Some of them were standalone devices like this. Some of them would go inside of your printer if it had a little expansion port. And basically, you know, I guess in the case of the Apple II, software was set typically to print through the serial port. Apple only sold, with an exception early on, they standardized on serial printers, which is not the way anyone else in the industry far and wide standardized. They were all using, you know, parallel. And so PCs and, you know, different other, I mean, I guess worked Unix type workstations was a little bit different, but for anyway, PC clones and a lot of other platforms, you know, Amiga, Atari ST would use parallel. So there were a lot of parallel printers out there that weren't made by Apple, and these converters would let you take, you know, like a parallel Epson, you know, LX80, and use it with your, you know, 2C in such a way that it, you know, when the application went to print to the serial port, this device would interpret the signals, and you'd get some sort of printing. And I guess it would be a lot. I don't know if it's a full standard, but you know, there's when you're printing ASCII text. You know, there are certain standards for ASCII characters that represent, you know, line feed, carriage return, that sort of thing, and the text of the letters themselves. But for graphics, I don't think it's. I'm curious. I wonder if, you know, I don't know that there was like a big standard among different vendors for how this worked. And it made me, like, I always had a feeling that it seemed kind of a curious and iffy proposition to have, you know, one device print, you know, from this totally different protocol, you know, different delivery mechanism of data, and have it work. That said, I had an Amiga. I mean, you could choose the serial port to print, but most apps and the system want, you know, expected a parallel, you know, printing to happen. And I had an ImageWriter 2 left over from an Apple IIgs that I had previously. Sometime previously. And so the Orange Micro made this serial to parallel converter in it, and you actually went inside the ImageWriter 2. It has a expansion slot or two inside. I think it provided, you know, a minimal print buffer, 64K of RAM or something, but it also did the conversion. And I was able to, like, the Amiga software had ImageWriter 2 as an option, or maybe I downloaded the driver, and, you know, I had this thing in place. I cabled it you know, to the parallel port, and then, you know, it did the switch, and it printed. I was able to print images with it, and I never really understood how that was able to work. I mean, I was younger then. I did, you know, didn't really dig into how these things worked, and it sort of shocked me. I didn't use it heavily for graphics, but do you have a big, you know, any lengthy experience with any of these, either of you guys, any of these, you know, converters? Have they worked well? I would anticipate that surely anyone that's used them in multiple instances would have had some non-success stories. It just seems crazy. It seems like
I don't have any experience with the converters, but I can speak a bit about like the graphics printing. I remember messing with that. And like, so if you had a typical like dot matrix printer back in the day, you'd enable graphics through like a series of like sending it weird control, kind of escape codes.
So it was
like, whether it was serial or parallel didn't really matter. You know, if it was getting one bit at a time or one byte at a time, it didn't matter. Because on your computer, you're typing one byte at a time, you know, to send it data. So, like,
right.
I think the thing between serial and parallel is more about you've got to handle, like, buffering somehow, waiting for 8 bits to come in, and then we have a byte, that kind of thing, or vice versa. But, like, the actual... Yeah. So like, the protocol switching, I can see how that's kind of independent of the actual, like, content production. Because the graphics is more about, okay, does my software know how to turn on the graphics code in this... graphics mode in this printer and send out the data in the right format for it? And then I think the serial or parallel doesn't really matter that much.
Maybe I had a overly complex view of it. And yes, I know I remember, you know, tweaking some escape codes to, you know, at the init string of a 24-pin dot matrix printer. I basically had an Epson AP3250 later on, which is basically, you know, your HP inkjets or the Apple style writer that, you know, did such a nice job laser-like with inkjet. This was one of those, but it used a 24-pin, you know, printhead, and it actually didn't take tractor feed. It took individual sheet feeders. It for all intents and purposes, you know, was a style writer, and it did a great job. But yes, in order to get it to take full advantage of the 24-pin, or it might even have been 27-pin, you had to load it up with these escape cue codes, you know, to get it in the right mood. And, you know, I got the Amiga to do that, and so I was in a happy place. But yeah, I guess maybe it was, you know, I know with like PostScript, you know, you can send, you got laser printers with Ethernet, USB, you know, serial, you know, like, I guess somehow PostScript seemed, okay, this is a defined language. But yeah, I guess this you're telling me, and I'm kind of coming around to the notion of, yeah, I guess the escape codes, you know, are not unlike that.
Yeah, it's also a language of sorts, or it's a protocol. Like, it's a, you know, if you define your data, your byte stream for this printer, and send it to it in whatever way it can get it, then it will know how to turn on graphics mode and print your thing.
Yeah. Did you have much call to use these devices, Paul?
I think I mostly had printers that didn't. Well, so I had an image writer too, and that sort of that did only graphics. But then, I think most of the other printers I either didn't have the graphics capable ones, or I never quite did much with them. So I do kind of remember these escape codes being sent to an Epson, but I really did feel like this was all individual to the printer. Like, you know, I had to, my combination of interface card and printer allowed me to do this particular thing, but I wouldn't expect anyone else's computer to be able to do it.
It's kind of what I was feeling. It like I said, in that one situation, you know, it worked for me, you know, and it just worked pretty smoothly. I was sort of astonished. Now I look back and I wish I, you know, I'm tempted to buy another, you know, orange micro card to all right, I'm going to see how this thing works. But yeah, I think what Jack is saying, that's educational to me. I think that makes sense, actually. I mean, yeah, that's, and that was a big thing. I mean, because, you know, Apple's printers were very expensive, you know, and, you know, they were good, and they were very, very reliable. Like the ImageWriter and the ImageWriter 2, you could drive over them and they would still work, you know, for 50 years or something. But yeah, you could get a decent Epson for like a quarter of the price, you know, and that was the appeal of these things, I think. So, okay. Well,
Yeah, the Integrator 2 is really, like, I really like that printer in a way because it interfaces with everything, you know, within its kind of time frame. You know, so you can put it on an Apple II, you can put it on a Mac, so you can put it on
Lisa. Yeah, I mean, even as it is, it's RS422. You can plug it right into a LocalTalk, right? Into the LocalTalk bus, correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Like it can be an AppleTalk device or just serial or... Mm-hmm. And I think... Well, I might be wrong. I was thinking that
There's a add-on, I think, that you need for the AppleTalk, but...
Maybe so. But it was an option, and... yeah. Okay.
I think Practical Peripherals also... Like, one of the things that I know them for is printer buffers, which is kind of... You know, like, you can see how that's the same kind of world. Like, if you're already collecting printer information and then sending it out to a printer, you might as well change the protocol while you're at it. So...
Yeah, I remember...
A small step from that point.
Yes, I can picture there's like an Apple IIc targeted device that had an interesting industrial design. It was this rounded thing with a little control deck on the left. And yeah, I think it was a buffer, you know, so you could send that term paper to your printer and then, you know, go play some Conan while it's printing or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, so,
and
okay.
Then go back to, like... Your paper, you know, jammed and all fed all over the room.
Yes, indeed. But okay. So anyway, that was mainly just to kind of talk about that a little bit. And I guess I'll do my. I have one more item that I can do, and this is, you know, it's not exceptionally retro, but a little bit. It is a rare iMac Timex alarm clock. Rare, again, stated, purple, new, still sealed, for $219. Right there, the title, rare. Mm-hmm. Yeah, rare. Ooh. Is twice rare. $219. Apparently, I guess it's new in box. It is a Timex, there's no question. And it on the box, it looks like an iMac. You know, it's a purple iMac here with the first iMac,
is it officially? Like,
that's the question.
Is it Apple sanctioned?
That's the question. That's what I wanted to ask you guys about. So if you look at it, you know, it looks very much, it's unmistakably an iMac, you know, but it's, of course, it's not exact because it's got four control buttons across the front, but it even has a little plastic thing that looks like the CD tray. But if you look at the font, it looks like Alarm Clock is using Apple Garamond or something close. Timex made it, so I don't think Timex did a lot of, you know, scammy rips or anything like that.
I don't know. Wasn't there like an e-machine or something like that that looked just like this too? Wasn't there? I thought there was some, like, as soon as Apple came out with the iMac design, then there were all kinds of other, like, clone, translucent colored clone things.
I guess I was looking to see, and I can't find that it actually says iMac, but I mean, it looks down to the little color piece at the top. Is that what you think's going on? That it's simply cloning a
popular design. Yeah.
I mean, it looks way more like an iMac than the e-machine does. Like, the shape is exactly that of the iMac, whereas the e-machine had that weird, shape. I don't think it can be official, but again, Timex made it. I wonder if anything ever came of this, if it wasn't official. They've got different colors, the various colors that you can, you know, that some of the ones that Apple offered.
I mean, I wonder, like, to what extent is the design of an iMac copyrightable or something? Like, if you came out with a computer contemporary with the iMac that actually had the exact same, like, you know, pretty much the exact same mold as the iMac, then Apple could say, hey, wait a minute, you're copying our design. But if you're coming out with an entirely different product, that's a small alarm clock that no one will confuse for being an actual iMac. No one will think this thing is an iMac. I hope.
I mean, it depends on your depth perception and how far across the room. You know, if you've got the clock close on the desk and you've got the iMac over there, you know, you might have some trouble. But
I mean, that reminds me. Look at my Atari 800XL. What? It's a keychain.
Exactly. You're giving me flashbacks to the Top Secret, you know, with the magnifying glass and the big eye, the big phone. I'm going to have
Top Secret had a bunch of that stuff.
Answer the phone. Yeah, that's good. I don't know. And of course, you know, it has those four buttons across the front. Well, the iMac doesn't have those four buttons, right? So,
right.
Yeah, I just thought it grabbed my eye. I'd actually like to have one. I've gotten into, I have a strange new habit of like picking up clocks that resemble old things that aren't clocks. But I'm not going to pay 200 and whatever that was for that. But anyway, that's all I've got for eBay this time around. And cool. There you okay. go.
I have this. I thought this was kind of an interesting device. It has long since sold, although it actually, it ended in December 2020. So it has been sitting in my documents for a while, but it had ended before I was even, before it was actually going to be talked about in the first place. But I thought it was interesting enough that it might be worth just kind of showing it, just because it's a thing that showed up. It's a GTE XT300. And it actually sold for $100, which is it's insane. Actually, it should have gotten more than that.
It's pretty low.
It's a little information terminal of some kind. So it's got it's got a keyboard and a built-in screen, and it's got a phone, like a cradle attached to it. So I guess the idea is that you would, if in your at your telemarketing job or whatever, you could sign into the mainframe and read your scripts.
Is it, as far as you can tell, is it a standard terminal? It's not riding some network that's phone-based. I mean, the terminal aspect is just like a serial dumb terminal. Is that right?
Well, I think more or less. I think so. From what I understood, it actually has a ROM. It is a kind of a computer, and that ROM has a terminal program in it.
Sure.
So you can use it to call CompuServe. The thing that's cool about this is that it's really quite complete. I mean, like, it's got some water damage on the box and stuff, but I mean, it's got all the manuals and all kinds of stuff. But anyway, it looked neat and not huge. It would have been. I was tempted, but it was December and there was no place to put such things. Ultra rare, made in France, it says. So I actually went and found some ads. You can find an ad that says the most important thing about this telephone is that it isn't just a telephone, and the GTE XT300 ad talking about the use of the information station. The compact desk unit you're looking at is GTE's new XT300 action station, and it can do some amazing things for a telephone. So it is, it's, I suppose, an early iPhone, you might say. It is the, marrying the idea of a computer and a phone.
I found a little, there's another I think an aftermarket reseller that kind of drops the specs pretty in a quick little burst for the thing. It looks like it's 9-inch CRT. 80 by 25 characters, RS-232C, works up to 4800 baud. Interesting. Yeah.
Yep. And it includes a free CompuServe intro pack. Yeah. Yeah. So this is on Ben Edwards' site, vintagecomputing.com, or, it's a retro scan of the week from some long past week.
Okay. Yeah. That's the same ad. Right.
I noticed the ad was from Comb. Do you guys remember Comb?
No. Do you know Comb?
Were they kind of like DAC?
I don't know what DAC was.
Yeah, it looks like DAC to me.
Comb was okay. We had one in Austin, Minnesota for a while. Comb was it was like a dumping ground of like cheap stuff that they kind of like whatever, like, a truckload of stuff, almost like a surplus store.
Yep. Right.
And they would have things like, they would have like off-brand Walkmans and stuff, and like weird electronics, and I remember they had boxed Apple II and Atari 8-bit floppy disk based games that were so cheap they were cheaper than buying blank disks, and they had so many, they had like, they would have hundreds of copies of the same game of some kind, like that they had bought from somebody. And I remember my friends and I buying those to use them as blank disks, because they were just to reformat them and use them, because it was cheaper than buying normal floppies.
Yeah, I've heard of Comb. I don't think I'd ever come across a catalog.
Yeah, I don't remember ever seeing a catalog. It was fun to go to the place and roam around and see what weird stuff they had that week.
So Blake mentioned the DAC catalog, and the DAC catalog is something that's quite familiar to me. And So Cable from Panic at one point was getting these and scanning them, and so I mean, this is actually quite some time ago. This is 2012, apparently. It seems like just yesterday, but so he's written up a thing about them and did scan a few. But this is one of the places where you could get everybody, get your bingo cards ready.
PX8.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was pretty cool because this particular one was, it was called DAC because it was based on this guy's name, Drew Allen Kaplan, and you know he would write these very flowery descriptions of like how great this technology was, that he was, that they'd managed to get like the large set of remainders or whatever, and they're now passing it on to you, and these are great, and they're really fun to read, actually.
Yeah. He was very much a cheerleader, and I remember, like, almost 100% certain I'm right that at one point they were selling Atari STs, like they had an Atari ST bundle, and they were comparing it to like the Amiga, and the cheerleadery, like, it was really slamming the Amiga in every way, like the Amiga is more like a toy than a computer, it was just funny. And yeah, I've actually bought some, we got the DAC catalogs, and they were great to read. You'd look through them, and they had lots of things like Emerson brands, which, like, things that were sort of like kind of cheesy, they weren't really highest of tech, but he really played them up. And yeah, I think I remember buying these just blank audio tapes from them because they were cheap, but like there were two pages expounding the rare audio virtues of the magnetic media in these tapes. It was like some, it was a lost formula from a lab, that had been, just funny.
Yeah, they're definitely fun to read.
I actually had a friend of mine, this was in, I think, the eighth grade, moved out of town. And we were big DAC fans. Like, we would buy the things. And when he moved away, as a kind of like a, because phone calls were, expensive, long distance, he moved to, other side of the state. We would, like, on several occasions, buy each other at the same time some random cheap DAC thing and mail it to them, like have it delivered to their house. That was something we did for like 2 or 3 months, to kind of keep in touch. And that was bizarre. But yeah, DAC.
Nice.
Weird times.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. So let's see. Was there anything else that I wanted to mention? Well, here. Yeah, maybe. I thought this was kind of cool. This has been sitting in my list for a long time. But this is a PowerPoint manual from the time when there were manuals. And so one thing that's actually kind of cool about this is that it says PowerPoint Forethought at the bottom, because PowerPoint was originally made by Forethought and bought by Microsoft. So this is the manual that actually goes with the original one. In fact, actually, as I recall, PowerPoint version 1 from Microsoft was basically just this with a sticker on it. They put Microsoft sticker over the Forethought part.
And I guess you're saying that, so PowerPoint as it existed from Forethought was originally a Mac release.
I think that is correct. Yes, PowerPoint 1.0 was released in 1987 for the Apple Macintosh. So, yeah. It's actually sort of interesting. So Forethought is... There's kind of a deep Apple connection with that, because Taylor Pullman is one of the two people who founded Forethought. He and Rob Campbell left Apple. I'm not sure if Rob Campbell was at Apple, but Taylor Pullman definitely was. So they founded Forethought, made PowerPoint, and then sold PowerPoint. And I'm not sure much else happened with Forethought after that. But it's the Silicon Valley dream, right?
I guess Apple purchased Forethought and PowerPoint together for $14 million in 1987. Microsoft.
Microsoft, Apple. Yeah. So there was a time before there was PowerPoint. And some people would have you believe that everybody's lectures were interesting during those days. But
yes.
Anyway.
Am I remembering that Microsoft Excel also appeared first on the Macintosh? Or is that not the case?
I do not know.
I felt like that was the case, but I don't want to spread misinformation.
Yeah, actually, I suppose we could just confidently say Microsoft Excel also started on the Macintosh. And no, Microsoft Excel did not start on the Macintosh. And then whichever one is true makes it into the edit.
Actually, yes.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the like you can get celebrity voices doing your GPS or whatever. From what I understand, the way they do that, or at least the way they used to do that, maybe it's fancier now, is they would just the celebrities would read some priest's preset, you know, a set of a bunch of phrases that contains all of the right pieces that you can sort of put together. So, or it starts with a stuh, then you know, then you've got somewhere a place you can pull the stuh from, and. So we can do our podcast in that same way. Just say all possible facts and then just assemble them. Keep only the true ones.
Yes. I see that indeed Excel was released for the Mac first before it was available on DOS or Windows. And in fact, there was never a version of Excel for DOS. So yeah, it was Mac first. I was right. I knew I remembered that.
Oh, interesting.
Cool. Yeah.
But was it Microsoft from the beginning or not?
That I'm not sure of. I think it was.
Because it seems like at that point that you know there was Lotus 1-2-3 and there
right.
was VisiCalc. There were things that it was reacting to. It wasn't like a new category.
Yeah. Right. I found the Version Museum, a visual history of your favorite technology.
Oh, wow,
I've Version never heard Museum. Of the Version Museum. Have you guys heard of this? Thank you for visiting the museum. Buy us a coffee. They talk about Microsoft Multiplan. They're taking us through screenshots, and it's in this museum. It's termed the first mention of it for version 1.0 is Microsoft Excel 1 for Mac. So I think it was probably developed by Microsoft, as Jack says. Right, they were obviously competing with, because I don't think Lotus 1-2-3 had certainly not yet brought Lotus or. I guess at some, I don't know if they ever did to the Mac, but they hadn't done it at this point. I guess Microsoft was trying to, you know, beat that potential inevitability. And they take you right through the, there's version 2.0 for Windows 1.0, or maybe Windows 2.0, but pre 3.1. Yes, if you want to, we'll put That's it in the show fun. Notes. If you'd like to know a great deal of historical version information about the evolution of Microsoft Excel, the Version Museum will take you there. I'm actually going to have to spend more time investigating this Version Museum. It sounds like they, I see they've got galleries of Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, New York Times.
I like this a lot.
It seems really good. And this page in particular is excellent.
This is pretty good. Let me click over to, let me click on, let's see, maybe Yahoo. What's it going to tell us?
So now? Yeah, I remember the transition of Word. You know, like so, there was Word on the Mac, and it seemed and I was using Word for DOS also, and they seem entirely unrelated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
do you know? I remember Microsoft on the Atari ST. There was a GUI-ish version that Microsoft released, something called Microsoft Write. Did that exist on the Mac first as a light version? Because Microsoft Write was much smaller, but it was Microsoft. I don't know. I didn't know there was Word for DOS.
Yeah. I don't think it made it past version 2 or something, but...
So what I'm scrolling through here is that I clicked on Yahoo. They've got a series of Yahoo. Now, this is more just like a kind of a web archive sort of thing.
Yeah, the version site, it does seem to have both websites and apps.
I guess they have, there's application. Okay. So they have websites, they have applications. You know, Excel is one of the applications, I guess, you know, Microsoft Word is another one. Microsoft Word 1 for DOS. And we're showing the Word version 1.15 for DOS with a little graphical title screen and Word for version 1.0 for the Mac in 1985. Clearly, that was the first GUI, like full GUI version of Word, because Windows proper like hadn't really come to exist with graphics yet. Interesting. Microsoft Word 3.0 for Xenix. For Xenix.
So yeah, if you used any of these, it is pretty nostalgic to see all these screens come back up.
Yeah.
Right.
And here we go, Microsoft Word 1.0 for Windows.
A lot of the stuff you could get on you know, like the Internet Archive or Wayback Machine or whatever, but it's pretty cool having it all just laid out for you. Like, mm-hmm. you don't have to wait
yeah,
for
sure. the big scroll sure. list. It's kind of neat.
There's a website out there called, it's something like GUI Gallery. They have it, you know, this has mm-hmm. some on the sidebar here. There's a handful of operating systems. Oh, you know what it is? It's called Guidebook Gallery. And it's basically, okay, see, they've got screenshots of just a good number of OS. I mean, I guess not every OS, but Irix, LibreOffice system, Amiga OS, Mac OS, Next Step. Here's a, let's take a look, you know, OS 2 Warp 3, and you click it and it, oop, technical problems. Page is not available. Okay. How about the Irix 5.3? Okay, and there you awesome. Go. So they give you, like, here's a opening shot of Irix 3 desktop. Here's the empty desktop, and there's a shot of the desktop with application. So, you know, if you wanted a feel for some of the interface widgets, I always like this site. I would reference it when I'm, you know, trying to, I'll post a story about some, you know, old version of an OS, and I like, oh, wait a minute, was that, did it look like this or that? And then you can find it, mm-hmm. Amiga Workbench 2.04 versus, you know, 3.1. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has been around for quite a while.
All right, so I have to make a note of that. Where does it go? I don't know. Let's see. Where were we? What were we doing? We were doing eBay auctions.
We were doing...
Oh, yes, that was for yep. the PowerPoint.
That's yes, right. you did PowerPoint.
PowerPoint, that was it.
Yep. Okay. I think that's it for my eBay auctions. I mostly did not get a chance to look at new ones. So I guess with that, we can end with eBay and move on to the closing discussions. All of us present here have written nothing in the closing discussion section, but perhaps we have things that we can discuss in closing anyway. Blake,
I
do.
I have some things.
Oh,
so
Jack
I have.
Did. Okay.
I didn't write anything though.
Okay, that's all right.
But again, I did. I actually wanted to more carefully show my very cool keychain. That so I forget who it was. Somebody posted this in one of the Atari groups on Facebook, saying he was making these. Some guy in the Netherlands. And, like, it's incredibly detailed. Every little key bump, every little, the ports on the back.
Okay. So it is 3D.
And he's even got the color down. So it is like the, it is the color of a yellowed 800XL.
That's impressive.
So, like, if I hold up, here's my actual 800XL. He got the color pretty good. Okay, his color is a little bit more yellow.
You might need to retro-bright that. You
could always... This leads into the next thing I wanted to show you. So this is my 800XL that my father bought and was in his house for many, many years. Mm-hmm. I've had it here for a while now. And it's somewhat yellowish. Like, it's nowhere near the original color. And then a couple of years ago, or a year, maybe just a year ago, I bought a 600XL. Mm-hmm. And I was disappointed when it came because it was so very, very yellow. Mm-hmm. I don't want to offend people who smoke, but I want to say, like, smoker's teeth yellow. Like, if you think of, like, just like how ugly something can become yellow that should not be yellow, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And I did a few weeks ago my very first retro bright, and it worked swimmingly well. So here's the 600XL. You see, it's
brighter.
Lighter in color than the 800XL. And when I got it, it was very much darker yellow, gross.
Wow.
So I'm really pleased with how well the retro brighting worked.
Nice.
It's very nice.
Yeah, I always worry a little bit about the, like, you know, the getting, I forget what you call it, but the, like, patterning on this. But so yours, it went pretty evenly on yours?
Yeah. Okay. So I didn't do the thing of soaking it in, like, a liquid. Mm-hmm. I got the cream hair, hair bleaching stuff, the peroxide. It's like, you know, what is it? 12% peroxide.
You mixed your own RetroBrite?
And I just sort of,
I know some people sell, like, a pre-mix of it. I wondered if you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I bought this. So this guy, Jonathan Halliday, I think is his name, Flash Jazz Cat. He does Atari stuff. He had posted that he had done this, and I followed his advice. And so you can buy on Amazon. I bought a big bottle of this hair bleach that is, like, it's 12% hydrogen peroxide, and it says it's 40 vol. I don't know what that means, but that's the... That's also a term you need to search for if you're searching for this thing. And I spread it on there like paint, and then I wrapped it in like plastic wrap to keep it from drying out. And since there isn't sunlight here, this time of year especially, I So the other thing that he recommended to do was to make a light box. So I took a cardboard box, like a big, like a moving box kind of thing, lined all the inside with aluminum foil, and cut holes in the top that perfectly match this lamp I have that projects a lot of light for growing plants. Mm-hmm. And I put this in the box, put the lights over in the top, shine down there, 24 hours, mm-hmm. and it came out like almost like new, virtually like new in terms of the color of the thing.
Interesting.
It was surprisingly easy and felt very sort of like low tech solution, mm-hmm. like, but it's cool.
I recently saw someone in a video. You know, I've never actually done a RetroBrite thing. I'm well aware of it, and I've seen lots of different approaches. But yeah, I think maybe it's what you were talking about, Paul. Someone, you know, they wrap it in cellophane. I guess that's to keep the air off or something like that. But it was to do.
It's to keep the thing moist. But this cream that you put in there to keep it moist, so it's activated
because of, you know, the nature of, you know, that scenario where it's not like a sheet of glass, the ripples in the cellophane presumably caused different light patterns. Is that what you were talking about, Paul? Is that what you're asking about?
Well, it's more or less, I guess. I mean, like, I think the issue is just that, you know, if you have, you know, it's a bleaching agent of some kind, or at least that is how I think it works. And so if you have it spread unevenly in any way, you would wind up seeing it. But
okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, mine, I didn't, you know, I just spread it on fairly amateurly. I didn't like, you know, I tried to make it as even as I reasonably could, but I didn't like obsess about it. But I think it came out really nice.
It's
very white. It's not really yellow at all anymore. And I don't have any kind of, I think they call it like blossoming sometimes.
Yeah. You see this like pattern of,
And I didn't have any of that happen at all.
I know
so I was very pleased with that.
The fellow that helped you out with that, Jazz Cat, he, you know, makes the firmware for that Ultimate 1 Meg. Did you install that in the 600 XL yet? Oh, you did. Okay. Nice.
That did not yet do, but I will.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I've been enjoying mine.
I've been enjoying mine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I've been meaning to. The other thing I can show you guys, I think I did talk about this, that I got this Lynx.
Oh,
from my nice girl from my birthday, and just I've forgotten how fat these things are.
Yeah,
but the thing is that like it's really comfortable in your hands because it is so wide. And then the nice thing though is that the cartridges are super super skinny instead. And I got this. Benven makes these. I think it's called the El Cheapo SD card thing, and it's got a very nice sort of. It's like an injection molded thing that has like a crazy color pattern.
All the games.
And so I have all the games pretty much. There's some homebrew I haven't put on here yet, but I will want to get around to it.
I need to get one of those.
And the other thing I bought, Benven also sells a replacement screen that apparently is essentially drop-in, requires no soldering. You just like plug it in place of the old one, and is, you know, super bright like a modern telephone. I even connects to the brightness knobs. The brightness knob will work on that as well, and it draws less power than the built-in screen. So I will install that too. I haven't gotten to it, but I've been pleased that like the built-in screen is nicely bright anyway, brighter than I kind of thought it might be. I thought it might be a lot worse than this, but I thought it's pretty decent.
I don't know if
it's visible. It's decently bright.
I think you have a better I think I mentioned on an earlier show. I found in my wife's childhood bedroom closet shelf. She had an inbox Lynx 1. You have the Lynx 2, which is an improved.
Oh, okay. This is the Lynx 2.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, she had used it like one time, and it had like four, you know, two games or something. I got it, and I've got like five games. See, now I'm gonna have to go out and order that SD thing, like right in seconds from now. But do you know that I've looked at screen replacements? I think your screen is a lot better than the Lynx 1. I think because like the Lynx 1, it has the backlight,
could be,
but the viewing angle is dramatically. It really the range of comfortable viewing is very narrow. But do you happen to know offhand if that replacement screen would work with the Lynx 1, or is that...
I don't remember. It's clearly explained on the website. It's very clearly laid out what it works with, but I don't remember. Because he said different versions of this too. Like he had older versions that did require some soldering, and the current one, the latest one, does not.
Cool.
So there's been a variety of revisions.
Cool.
So
very cool.
Very nice.
Yep. Fun times. That's what I got. That's my closing notes, I'd say.
All right. Blake, you have any closing notes?
I guess I didn't write anything, but as I mentioned, I guess thinking about things that have happened in the last 2 weeks since we recorded, Jack is about to install the Ultimate 1 Meg upgrade for the Atari, which I installed in my 800XL, my PAL 800XL, to watch Demo Scene Productions, and it's been great. I need, I don't have the snazzy, FujiNet right now, but I do have a SD, SD device that I can load up, and it's been nice. When a demo has, instead of 64K, it's got, 320K or 1 megabyte, that makes quite a difference as far as what they can make. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. That was easy to install too. That was an easy one. I've been enjoying the, I mentioned the Amiga Parcero device, which replaced two sidecar expansions and two external SCSI drives with something that's the size of a credit card holder, 8 megs RAM, real-time clock, and a SD hard drive, alternative that is FAT32, so you can just pop it into your PC and you see the Amiga file system. You can just drag things. I was hoping to have written it up. I mean, I want to write up, do a post about that, but I haven't done that yet. Mm-hmm. So I want to do that, and maybe, we could share that. That's quite a device. But again, it's for the Amiga 1000, and it's I don't know how many people are out there using them, but and it's nice for those of us that have it. But so. That's, I guess, the bulk of it. It's nice to divert oneself with, retro activities. And how about you then? Aside from moving, Paul, what's your situation?
No, yeah, I guess it's in a sense I kind of put all my closing thoughts up at the beginning.
Okay.
but yeah, I mean, I guess I'm definitely looking forward to setting up all the things. I'm hoping that I brought all the pieces that I need, because it's not like I can just order them easily, but so we'll see. But hopefully I'll have a working cube that I can play whatever, what was the Asteroids game? I forget. I used to play that a lot. Ambrosia Software.
Oh, Maelstrom.
That's it. Maelstrom. Yeah.
Maelstrom, right. Yeah.
But anyway, that's my goal, is to get a couple of those things set up, and maybe next time I can point a camera at them. You can see them running.
Nice. Are you going to be bringing the vast majority of the things that are currently in your workspace to the new dwelling, or not so much?
Probably not. Not. I mean, like I am actually planning on spending a fair amount of the time this coming year, like downsizing, so I don't have, quite so many, Mac SEs, that kind of thing. But I think I'll probably sort of split it up so that there'll still be some in my office in a kind of a display configuration, and there'll be some here that I use. And
try to find a cutoff line so you can keep just your 10 favorite Mac SEs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Just the top 10.
Reasonable about it. Yeah, 10. Just keep your 10. Keep the 10 favorite. Let the others go.
That's right. Anyway, but yeah, no, so okay. I'm looking forward to getting things, organized. I have a new chance to do this, so that's kind of fun.
Right.
Excellent.
And didn't you say you were going to rent a storage space or something, so you'd also have space to put things there and sort things out?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's so. I think the things that do leave, that I do move from my office / garage of a space at the university. Well, some of them are going to go into that storage space, and I have big plans. I usually have more. Okay. Like my plans are usually larger than my time, but
sure,
So that's, I think that's the human condition. So,
yes.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
Well, so good job, everyone.
we came in and left with almost
2 hours.
Yeah. That's good. Well, that's a good one, I think.
No, it's fun to record, even though, like, you know, so sorry again about not actually having the editing done. Of course, when you're listening to this on the feed, you will have heard the previous two because they will have made it to the feed first. But
right.
In the history, there's been a bit of a delay of getting those out. But it's fun to record, though. So I'm glad that we had a chance to do this. And thanks to the dozen or so people who are watching along, listening to all the bits that we will later cut out.
Yep.
So, and actually getting a chance to see, you know, Jack's 3D effects with his little keychain.
That's right.
Yeah. So, how did you work that magic?
I could try and do like some like forced perspective thing.
Yeah.
Like
Gandalf and Frodo, you know, on the cart.
Gandalf and Frodo.
What do you
each
say,
have their
Frodo?
Own, like,
right. That's just look
good.
To the side.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's.
I did something like that. Steve Wyrick, also a RCR member from way back, wrote a Apple II book. I think it's called Simplicity and Sophistication. Maybe it's the other way around. But it's actually got a sort of a corner of an Apple II Plus on the cover of it. And so I did a sort of similar photo where I held up an Apple II Plus at the right perspective so that it was actually like completing the rest of the Apple II Plus from the cover.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that photo.
Nice.
I'm gonna have to go watch Top Secret now after forced perspective gag. Non cheesy, of course.
I watched the first half of that, like pretty recently. I watched the first half of that, like 3 weeks ago or something like that. I'm sort of making my way through it, and it's still like I remember all of it. It didn't all age well.
Yeah.
But it's like Airplane too, right?
My daughter was, I was watching it and she came in, it was just on and I was standing there at the kitchen counter watching it and repeatedly still laughing out loud. And she finally just looked at me and walked out of the room. So, I don't know that it resonates with the youth of today. There's no counter for taste.
All right. So I guess maybe we can wrap it up. So
yeah.
That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and we will next time read all of it. I guess. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com, and if you wish, you can write a review on iTunes that allegedly helps people find the show. And then, until next time,
Retro-compute.
It's a place of love and color where pretty girls can fall from the sky.